The Harward Center is an academic center at Bates whose mission is to foster collaboration and civic engagement between the college and our larger community, both to bring the gifts and resources of an institution of higher education to community needs and community projects, but also to integrate citizenship and community engagement into the Bates education itself. Tonight's panel focuses on one of the most important and yet invisible issues confronting Maine, the issue of poverty. We've entitled it Poverty and the Two Maines to invoke a key phrase, the idea of the two Maines, that's often used when talking about and describing economic crisis in the state. This phrase of the two Maines is a useful rubric, it seems to me, for a couple of reasons. First of all, it points to the fact that inequality and poverty and economic hardship afflict our state, part of a growing trend nationally and internationally towards economic inequality, and a trend that in Maine has been made worse by crisis in many of the state's key traditional sectors, timber, paper, textile mills, fisheries, and the like. And secondly, the two Maines is a useful idea because it points to the problem of the invisibility of Maine's poverty, the idea that under the beauty of vacation lands, granite coasts, and mountains and lakes in the hinterlands, we have what's a much more complex landscape, a landscape of contradictions and sometimes hidden hardships. And yet, as I was thinking about the introduction tonight and thinking about the range of expertise and experience that our panelists represent, it struck me that even this image of the two Maines is too simple. We live in a state with a more complicated array of needs and resilience and poverty, where rural Mainers and new immigrants and deindustrialized workers and farmers and fishermen who face declining yields and migrant workers in the coastal tourism industries all contribute their own distinctive stories to this larger issue of poverty in Maine. Our guests tonight will help us map that complex landscape of poverty and policies of poverty, first by helping us describe the problem itself, and secondly, by offering their own stories and proposals for how to fight it. We have a distinguished panel tonight, full of diverse expertise and experience, folks from the worlds of policy, of journalism, and politics, and they'll give us much wisdom and insight on different aspects of the problem of poverty in Maine. Let me introduce them all now briefly in the order that we've asked them to speak, and then turn the floor over to them. Sarah Standifer is executive director of the Maine Women's Lobby and its sister organization, the Maine Women's Policy Center, leading both organizations in their work of research, policy development, and advocacy around issues affecting women and girls in Maine. She's been a leader on issues of affordable health care, reproductive privacy, economic security, and violence against women as a policymaker, as a board member in various commissions and community organizations, and as an activist. Before her work with the Maine Women's Lobby and the Policy Center, she was community organizing manager with Planned Parenthood of Northern New England, and before that, I am proud to say she was a Bates graduate, majoring in anthropology. Naomi Shalit is the opinion page editor for the Kennebec Journal and Morning Sentinel, and the recipient this past year of New England AP's Award for Editorial Journalism. Before she joined the Journal editorial board in spring of 2006?
It feels like 20 years ago, but I think that's what it was, yes.
She was well known in Maine as an environmental activist and as a reporter, having served as the executive director of Maine Rivers from 1998 to 2003, and before that as a reporter and producer for Maine Public Radio and a columnist for the Maine Times. She is not, I'm sorry to say, a Bates alum. And worse than that, she's a Bowdoin parent. But we're large-minded here. This summer, she published an important series entitled For I Was Hungry, a week-long documentary and editorial series on the pages of the Kennebec Journal on hunger and food insecurity. And in fact, we have condensed copies of that really important series here if if you want to pick one up and take it home with you. Her investigative writing helped to place these issues of hunger and food insecurity back on the public agenda in Maine, and I look forward to hearing more about them tonight. Eric Smith is Congregational Outreach Coordinator for the Maine Council of Churches, working with churches across the state, especially on issues of social justice. Before joining the Maine Council of Churches, he was Assistant Minister for the First Parish Church, United Church of Christ, in Gorham, Maine, where his portfolio included issues of environmental stewardship and hunger and other issues. He served on the national staff of the National Council of Churches and on its youth adult ministry team. He studied at the University of Southern Maine and Chicago Theological Seminary. And finally, Hannah Pingree is serving her third term in the Maine House of Representatives, representing her own home community of North Haven and nine other Mid-Coast Island and coastal communities. She serves as the House Chair of the Joint Legislative Committee on Health and Human Services, and this term her Democratic colleagues elected her Majority Leader of the House. In addition to her legislative service, she works as Development Director for Waterman's Community Center in North Haven and serves on many community boards and civic initiatives in the Mid-Coast. She grew up in North Haven and was a graduate of its community school, one of five in the graduating class, as well as Brown University. Welcome to all of you, and thanks. We look forward to hearing your thoughts on the issue. We've asked each of our speakers to speak for about 10 or 15 minutes each, after which there will be ample opportunity for questions and dialogue, both with you and with each other. Sarah, over to you.
Thank you very much, David. Thank you to all for being here. It's really a great pleasure to be on a panel with these distinguished folks and Senator Rotundo, and I see Representative O'Brien in the background as well. This is a great community, and I'm here to tell you that social anthropology is a viable profession. Just tell Professor Danforth. So I want to tell you a little bit about why I'm here, why I think I'm here, because to me, you can't talk about poverty without talking about the role of women in the economy, and you can't talk about poverty without talking about work. And so those are the lenses by which the Maine Women's Lobby evaluates much of the policy that comes before the state legislature and that we work to advance. Just as a little bit of background, the Maine Women's Lobby was founded 30 years ago by a group of women, four women who had come back from the National Women's Conference in Houston, Texas. This is 1978. And felt empowered and inspired to do something in the state of Maine to specifically benefit women and girls. And what they devised and what they identified as the greatest need was to fund, at that time, a very struggling network of battered women's shelters and to make sure that there was a state commitment to making sure that those programs existed to serve survivors. And so they put together a group of people interested in this issue. They identified legislative sponsors. They worked with those sponsors to draft legislation to fund those shelters. They had support from both sides of the aisle. They had broad support, and they went before a public hearing, empowered with stories that were very compelling to the committee. And they received every assurance that the bill would pass, and indeed it did. But ultimately, what happened was this piece of legislation that everybody had supported died ultimately on the appropriations table, as Senator Rotundo will tell you, where many things go to rest, because decisions about funding were being made. And when they talked to their sponsors and their allies on this issue, what they learned was that the reason the bill hadn't successfully been appropriated was that women weren't represented as an interest group. And that's when they decided to form an organization whose sole purpose was to make sure that there's a woman in the state house, a woman or man, in the state house representing women's interests. And we have done so since 1979. And the reason I give that story is because there's a sense, I think, of what we envision to be women's issues. Ultimately, when I talk to people in forums like this one, and you ask what is a woman's issue, the first thing that comes up is, you know, reproductive privacy or domestic violence, or even healthcare. But what we know is that so many issues, in fact, almost every issue that comes before the state legislature, has a very distinct and sometimes disproportionate impact on women. And economic security and the policies that set workplace standards are really one of those places where women have a very distinct perspective that we try to share. And in part, it's because of this work that Maine has made really important strides to lay the groundwork for women's economic security, including, for example, first in the nation legislation empowering women to take time off of work to care for themselves or their families in the case of sexual assault or domestic violence, or to attend to court proceedings. It's one of the reasons why Maine was one of the first states in the nation to enact family medical leave protections. It's one of the reasons why Maine was the only state in the nation to enact guidelines for implementing a model equal pay law to make sure that women are paid fairly for the value of their work. And so these are not, this is not an academic exercise when we talk about women's role in the economy. What we endeavor to do is to make sure that there are real policies in place to have an effect on everybody's lives. Because we know also that when you create economic security for women, that has an effect not only on women, but also their families and their communities. So that's my perspective, and obviously it's a very distinct perspective. There's a lot left to do, and poverty is really at the core of our agenda. You know, we talk a lot about the glass ceiling when it comes to women's role in the workplace, and the glass ceiling being the traditional the career ladder ending to stymie women's advancement at the upper echelons of the workplace. But what we, I think, most need to be concerned about is the sticky floor that keeps women in low-wage jobs and in non-family-supporting situations, because women are increasingly supporting their families with cash as well as with caregiving. According to the Maine Development Foundation, our state ranks 37th in the nation in 2005 for personal income rankings. And Maine's median estimated household income is a little over $30,000. That's the lowest of New England states, and it's below the national average. And one-third of all Mainers live in households with incomes below 200% of the federal poverty level. So, for example, that means a family of three would be getting by on about $35,000 a year. So we can, I think others will put some of these numbers forward, and we can really envision and imagine what it takes to get by for a family, to support a family on that amount. But the picture for Maine seems oftentimes bleak, because not only is poverty increasing, but the gap between those who have resources and those who don't is also increasing. So I want to talk about three specific elements of this briefly that I think are work together to make sure that poverty, that not only provide the framework for what poverty looks like in the state, but also the framework for solutions. Because as an advocate, we don't talk much about problems without talking about solutions, and that's our challenge in audiences like this one, is to join with us in doing so. One is earnings, because obviously in order to support a family, work needs to pay. But there's also the issue of family and the family penalty that many of us encounter when we are striving to work and support families, but hit the wall of what we can do because of the penalty that perhaps having children or caring for adult family members causes. And the third is the safety net, or what I would say is an inadequate safety net to support those of us who need it. So those are the lenses that I often bring to this issue. First, earnings. What does it take in order to get by in our state? The most recent calculation of what's called a basic needs budget, which is a calculation that an organization called the Maine Center for Economic Policy and now the Department of Labor conduct, really assesses what the actual costs are for living in the state, and they vary it. They do the assessment by region and by family size. They've calculated recently that one needs to have, on average, an hourly wage of $16.17 for a single adult with one child to get by. Statewide. And in short, according to the Maine Center for Economic Policy, a large share of the workforce, that's 366,000 people, or 61% of the workforce, was not making enough to get by in 2006. To me, that is an astounding number and really points to the importance of wages as a solution to solving the problem of poverty. But when you apply the lens of gender, you learn more. Nationally, 17% of women working full-time earn less than $15,000 a year. I think these are 2004 statistics. And women are more likely to be poor. In 2003, women were 40% more likely than men to be poor nationally. So again, you can't talk about poverty without talking about women. And when we talk about earnings, we learn that there are some differences there as well. Women, on average, make 76% of what men do in the state of Maine. So for every dollar that a man brings from the workplace, women on average earn 76 cents. That wage gap obviously has been part of our country for a very long time, and unfortunately, it hasn't changed too much. You know, we hear a lot these days about family values and personal responsibility. But the fact is that despite those sentiments, being a good family member can cost you your job. And so when we talk about poverty, oftentimes we talk about what happens when people are forced into positions where they're no longer able to bring home earnings. Work can't pay if it doesn't last, and it can't last if you can't care for your children and your adult family members. Here are a few of the dilemmas that I've encountered in the past couple of months talking to audiences like this one and in communities and our members about the challenges. Christina Griffin, who is somebody I work with closely from Portland, told us a story about getting a call from her daycare provider when her son was two. And she was told that she had to pick up her son from daycare because he had an ear infection, which is common, of course. And she was unable to take time off of work to pick him up because she wasn't empowered to use the sick days that she'd earned to care for a sick child. So she called her husband, who worked in a local bar in Portland, who didn't have any sick days at all. And he was able to go pick up his child and bring him back to the restaurant and make him comfortable in a back booth until the restaurant opened. At that point, Christina got off of work and was able to pick up Jacob. But by that time, he had a fever of 102 and had to be taken to the emergency room. So some people read that story and can read a story of, you know, bad decision, you know, by a parent, or it could read the story of impossible choices, you know, parents being made, or a story of, you know, what happens when daycares can't provide care for sick children. But when we read that story and when we heard that story, we heard the story of inadequate workplace standards that make it difficult to do the very necessary things that you need to do for your family when children are ill. And that's a story that we're hearing over and over again as we talk about this issue. We talked to Monique from Portland, who, you know, called her supervisor at a fast food restaurant when she had to stay home from work because of her two-year-old who had the flu. And her supervisor told her that she had to come in. She declined. And when she refused, her hours were cut from 40 to 15 per week, and she was demoted to mopping floors and cleaning toilets. These are the kinds of impossible choices that people make every day in our state and in our country, in part because the choices that we make between earning wages for our families and taking care of our families. And that's the dynamic that I think you cannot avoid when talking about poverty, particularly as the number of women with children in the workforce increases and as the number of people caring for elderly family members increases. You know, all families certainly need time to care, but it's low-wage workers who get, I believe, penalized the most for trying to be good family members. And those penalties can move people into poverty. For example, as I mentioned, getting fired for using your sick time to care for a sick child, not having access to affordable, accessible daycare, knowing that family medical leave is available for emergencies, chronic illnesses, but not being able to afford to use it because it's unpaid. And you know, while not everybody has occasion to need family medical leave for chronic illnesses, everybody gets sick with short-term illnesses. And that's a scenario that, unfortunately, for half of full-time workers who lack even one single paid sick days, can be the difference between having a job and not having a job. So, and there's also one other piece to the penalty for family care, and that is what I like to call the new glass ceiling, which is the unequal treatment of men and women in the workplace who have families. Because what a lot of people don't know is that in this state, as in all but two states, you can be fired or refused to be promoted simply because you have family caregiving needs. For example, as an employer, I can say, it seems like this job might be too much for you because you probably have too many responsibilities at home, so I'm not going to provide that promotion. And that's something that we don't hear a lot about right now, but again, as the as child rearing and care for adult family members' needs increase, we will be hearing more about. And then for the third piece, when you do fall through the cracks, when you do lose your job and fall into a situation of poverty, what supports are available to you? Traditionally, Maine has been a leader in really applying our shared values of community responsibility, mutual responsibility, to programs that provide supports for people in poverty. But unfortunately, that net has tremendous holes in it. When welfare, as we know it, was ended by people who didn't know it in the mid-90s, what happened was a public assistance program that tied a temporary amount of public assistance and a need to move off of assistance into work. And that program now, TANF, is less than I think we could all agree is needed to meet basic needs. The maximum monthly TANF assistance payment is $485 per month for a family of three. And in 2004, the average monthly cost per case in Maine was $386. So that's a family being supported on $386 per month. And that, to me, speaks to, again, the inadequacy of some of the supports that we really rely on to keep the poorest people in our state out of poverty. Fortunately, Maine has made important strides in tying public assistance opportunities to access to higher education through programs like Parents of Scholars. So there are solutions to this problem, but it takes vigilance and it takes ongoing work and support. So in summary, you know, for me, in order to realize not only equal opportunity for women, but a solution to poverty, we need to examine women's status in the economy. Women are disproportionately and chronically trapped in low-wage jobs. They comprise the majority of seasonal and part-time workers, are paid lower wages than men in comparable occupations, and carry the primary responsibilities for children, for care of children and adult family members. So while that can be a gloomy picture, what it also means is that our most effective and substantive economic security initiatives must target women to the benefit of all families. And the role of government and the role of public policy is to devise those solutions that have an impact throughout the state. And we have lots of ideas. But what I'll do is save some of those ideas for the further conversation, because there is much that the state has done, and there's much that we can do together to increase wages and end the pay gap, to end the penalty for family care, and to make sure that our public supports are really meeting our values of shared responsibility and community supports. So with that, I'll end and turn it over to Naomi.
There we go. Thank you, David and Peggy, for organizing this forum to address a very difficult problem, a problem that isn't spoken of nearly enough for what it is. And a problem that really, I think, quietly and profoundly shapes our lives here in Maine. Late last year, a legislator I knew in Western Maine told me that the food pantries in his district were experiencing really record demand. They weren't getting the deliveries of food from the feds that they used to get. They were running short of food and seeing more hungry people than they'd ever seen. I went out to Wilton in Western Maine on a Sunday afternoon in January. I met the lawmaker and drove around his district with him to the various food pantries exist in that area, and there are a lot of them because there are a lot of people who need help. And that was really the beginning of a six-month odyssey for me and the members of our paper's editorial board as we embarked on a major project to document hunger in Maine, which, in a fit of shameless hucksterism, I will remind you, is right up here in front, and we'd love you to take some because we've got a lot of them. Hunger is a shameful thing in this country, and it sounds like the sound system just went on. Okay. Thing in this country, an admission for some that they are not up to the most primal and compelling of jobs, which is feeding their families or even feeding themselves. But I was lucky because people chose to talk to me. They welcomed me into their kitchens and into their lives. They spoke of their pain at having to ask for a handout after a life of hard work, a life of paying taxes, of serving their country, of raising children. Some told me about their anguish and anger when, despite a college education and a job, they couldn't feed their kids. Some opened their refrigerator doors and showed me how little was inside. And this is what those people told me. They told me that they are not the only ones. There are tens of thousands of hungry people in Maine. They are old, they are young, they are veterans, they are children. In rural Anson up in Somerset County, the parents of 90% of the children in the elementary school there can't afford to feed them lunch. That's up from 60% in 1999. In Augusta's Gilbert Elementary School, that number currently hovers around 62%. There are countless elderly people in this state who thought their pensions and Social Security would be enough to support them when they got old. They were wrong. Every teacher I talked to knew of hungry kids in their classroom. Most of the teachers bought snacks for the kids with their own money. Every food service worker in a school that I talked to had stories upon stories of how, against the rules, they would slip extra servings of food to kids whose only meals were eaten in school. More and more working people are hungry as they watch their paychecks disappear into rising fuel, heating, insurance, and housing costs. And faced with this growth in Maine's hungry, it turns out that food pantry workers cannot keep up with the demand. At the state's largest soup kitchen and food pantry down in Portland, run by Preble Street, they used to do a food drive once a year, and now they do one every month, and they still have empty shelves. Of all the states in the nation, and this was one of the most shocking things that we found out, Maine had the highest growth rate of hungry people over the last 6 years. They just came out with the latest measurements last week, and we had found that that was the case for the period from 2001 to 2003. It's now the same for the period between 2003 and 2006, and we suspect that with the hike in fuel prices, it's going to be even worse in this year. Based on a study of census data, 9.2% of Maine households from 2001 to 2003 had what's called low or very low food security, meaning family members struggled to put food on their tables and children in those households went hungry. From 2004 to 2006, that number jumped to 12.9%. That represents a 40% increase. Yet this is a problem that we don't know about because people don't talk about it. And the very people who try to help with the problem, the food pantry workers, food bank folks, they're so good about not shaming anyone by identifying them that in a peculiar way they almost collude with keeping this problem as secret as it is. In spite of the growth in hungry people here in Maine, the amount of food delivered by the federal government to feed hungry Mainers has declined by half in the last 5 years. And you'll hear food pantry folks say, yeah, it's all going to Iraq. They're not getting it to, you know, we're sending it somewhere else. That's actually not true. The way we get that surplus food is it's surplus commodity food, and farm prices have been so high, the government doesn't need to buy that food and doesn't distribute it now in the amounts that they used to. The number of food pantries in this state skyrocketed from 450 in 2004 to 600 now, Almost every school we looked at had a higher percentage in 2006 of children eligible for free and reduced lunch than they had in 1999, and in some cases, a much higher percentage. Yet those children who are eligible for free meals aren't getting what they need. Only 42% of the children who get free lunches in our schools get free breakfast as well. So let me say that again. Fewer than half of those children whose parents can't afford to feed them breakfast are getting that breakfast at school despite the availability of federal money to pay for those breakfasts. And that means children who can't concentrate, who can't think hard, who don't behave well, and who may become serious problems in the classroom, who can't learn. Senator Rotundo here knows this very well because she put in a bill to try to feed those kids, and it didn't get as far as it needed to get, but it's got some. Let me introduce you to a few of the faces of hunger in Maine. First, to Farmingdale, which is near where I live in Hollowell, where I found it's the closest thing to Tobacco Road I've ever seen in my life. I found an old, crumpled farmhouse. I went to this woman's house, and I couldn't find the house because the place where she actually lives, in the midst of a lot of buildings and trailers and shacks and sheds and old refrigerators and various cars that don't have wheels on them and whatever. I didn't believe that anybody could live in the house where she actually did live, so I didn't even open a door on that one. And then she came whizzing out in this wheelchair because she's a double amputee and sort of waved her arms and said, "Over here," in this very cigarette-colored voice. 64-year-old Sandy Kalick, a double amputee, lives in this house. This is where her refrigerator holds a few bottles of salad dressing, half a dozen eggs, a jar of mayonnaise, a plastic container of leftovers from the night before, a turnip, and a cabbage. This is a place where Kalick gets her monthly food box delivered by the Gardner Food Bank. This is where a woman who worked hard her entire adult life until she lost her legs, earning $500 a week as a stitcher and equally good money at Amhigh and at the county jail, now lives on $657 a month in Social Security disability payments plus a little more in state aid. And she said to me, "Hungry? I've seen times when I have been." Here's the math at her house. She gets the $657 in Social Security, $10 a month from the state. She pays $250 for rent, $30 for electricity, $25 for the phone, $60 every month for fuel, $50 for cigarettes, and $45 for cable television. That leaves $48 a week for everything else, which is why she qualifies for $123 a month in food stamps. And that's where the Gardner Food Pantry comes in. Food Pantry, she says, they are awesome. They're just awesome. They deliver my stuff, bread, soups, rice-a-roni, canned fruits, potatoes, sometimes meat if they have it. Hot dogs, sandwich meat, cereal, and when the gardens are up, all kinds of vegetables. She alludes to another problem. The deliveries that the feds used to bring had a lot more protein in them in the old days. They have much less now than they ever did before. But she adds, when the food bank is low, you don't get much. And more that food bank is low. Then there was the 85-year-old veteran in Western Maine. "I just barely make it," the veteran says in a whisper, his red-rimmed eyes squinting in the bright light from his kitchen window. "There's a lady from the food pantry who brings all kinds of stuff once a month, cereals and soups and all that stuff. If they didn't bring it to me, I just have to get by best I can. And best I can for that elderly gentleman is a refrigerator filled with two eggs, a few bottles of salad dressing, some margarine and a packet of bologna that actually doesn't belong to him. It belongs to a young man who's staying in his house. There's a little cereal in the pantry, too, and the veteran's son says he doesn't get the food he needs. He's missing a lot of different vitamins. Right now, he has enough for another couple of days, but he's down pretty close. My father's worked hard in his life. He's served his country. He doesn't ask for nothing, and he deserves a lot better than he's got," says his son. And I asked this man, who himself is in his 50s, what would he say to someone who doesn't believe there's real hunger in Maine? Because there are a lot of folks out there who think that. "If they haven't seen this kind of life," says the son, "they're one lucky person." Then I got this email from a woman who runs the food program in Richmond schools. "I certainly can attest to many stories of students commenting on being hungry over the weekends, especially the 3-day weekends. Also, many come to school usually toward the end of the week and will speak very freely on how they are so hungry as their parents can't get groceries until payday. Both breakfast and lunch are most important and needed on those days. Students often will mention they are glad to be going on vacation, but they will miss us because they probably will only have one meal per day. A full tummy means a better focus, said one teacher in Wilton to me. We obviously know that, said her colleague. That's why we feed them before tests. I say you feed them on those days, feed them every day. And teachers routinely lay out money to feed hungry students. Every month last year in Maine, an average of 160,300 people got food stamps. 80% of benefits went to families with children, precisely what you were alluding to. 11% of food stamp recipients were over 60 years old, and folks in the state who dispense that program's benefits say that that's artificially low because older people are too proud to ask for food. And if you read the New York Times this weekend, there was an amazing article about poverty among the elderly up in the Down East area, including one man who said, well, we went to the food pantry when we were hungry, but there were people there who needed food more than we did, so we stopped going. In Franklin County, 13.6% of residents were food stamp recipients, and in Somerset County, 19% of residents got food stamps. In almost all cases, a family of three can get food stamps if its wage earner's monthly take-home pay is below $1,385. And go above that by trying to work your way out of that kind of poverty, and you lose your stamps. Total food stamp benefits in Maine last year amounted to $169 million. Yet that huge amount of money doesn't reflect the reality of food stamp benefits when they're seen from the individual level. Who knows how much food stamp for one meal benefit is? Anybody take a guess? It's a dollar, $21 a week. It doesn't take much analysis to appreciate that such a paltry amount of money can't possibly pay for a nutritious diet. If the legislators had to live on what we have to live on, they'd never be able to do it, says one recipient, which is where the food pantries come in. Where food stamps leave off, the saints of the state's church basements come in, feeding as many people in their communities as they can. And so in a state hungry for good economic news, the ironic fact is that one of the most booming businesses is serving food to the hungry. As mills close and Maine's economy shifts from high-paid industrial jobs to lower-paid service sector employment, food pantries are a growing sector with a growing market, but they can't satisfy the need, and the need is increasingly among working families. And according to the Good Shepherd Food Bank, whose head is right back here in the fourth row, Rick Small, it's the Auburn charity that buys or collects and then distributes reduced-cost food to thousands, to hundreds of state food pantries. In 2002, they distributed 8.4 million pounds of food, and this year they project they'll distribute 10 million pounds, an almost 20% increase. So what to do? Oh, let me just, one more statistic. Past 5 years, the value of USDA food sent to Maine for the hungry dropped from $2.39 million to $1 million. Ending hunger in Maine is a huge and long-term undertaking. The root causes of hunger are lack of economic opportunity. And the problem will be solved in two ways: economic development in Maine and greater access to higher education. But until those things happen, and they're going to be incremental as they happen, there are going to be a lot of hungry people in this state. So our newspapers made some very modest, but we believe crucial proposals to help the hungry right now. We said the state should mandate that all schools that serve reduced price and free lunch also offer reduced price and free breakfast and effectively promote that program so the percentage of students getting free and reduced price breakfast doubles. Federal government should increase food stamp benefits, whatever it takes to do it, and we're seeing that playing out in Washington now with a farm bill, which 60% of Agriculture Department spending is on nutrition programs, so it's a major part of the farm bill. Federal government must also raise the cutoff level for food stamps. Right now, it penalizes people for trying to work their way out of poverty, and that's just plain dumb. These are modest but essential moves that should be taken to begin the end of hunger in Maine, but there's other work that needs to be done as well. The story I've told you here today about the growing number of Maine's hungry was not met with a universally sympathetic response. We got a lot of letters and emails about this series, and they largely fell into two camps. Those who feel this country and state have given far too much already through social programs, and conversely, those who feel we must do more. There was particularly pungent and strong reader response to two specific things. First, that two of the hungry elderly women we profiled in our series smoked. Sandy Kalick, the double amputee, also got cable television in her Farmingdale home, and readers questioned why the government should be using our tax dollars to pay for food stamps for Kalick when she could have used her own money to pay for food, but instead used it for cigarettes and entertainment. If they're so poor and cannot afford food, why the heck are they buying cigarettes, wrote one reader. If I were going hungry, and they put hungry in quotes, I sure wouldn't be buying smokes. Our recommendation that the state should serve free and reduced price breakfast to all children who qualify for the meal was the second thing that provoked an outcry among some readers who said we were advocating a ludicrous and unwarranted extension of the welfare state that would force a hike in taxes. It is not the duty of taxpayers to take care of other people's children, wrote one reader online. I am sick and tired of paying for everyone else's bad decisions, poor work ethics, and irresponsibly, ignoring the fact that a lot of these kids have working parents. Will feeding more children in Maine a subsidized school breakfast mean higher taxes? Subsidized school breakfast and lunch programs are fully reimbursed by the federal government. Furthermore, we documented that children who go to school hungry don't learn well and ultimately cost the taxpayers of the state more money because they're statistically more likely to have special education and behavioral needs. But money isn't the obstacle here. There are other issues that are obstacles, logistical ones that discourage already overburdened school administrators. How do you serve breakfast and get kids to class on time? Do bus schedules need to be changed? Who serves the meal? And those aren't minor issues for school administrators and teachers. But serving more Maine children a free and reduced price breakfast will have little or no impact on Maine taxpayers. The money's there, it's been paid for, and it's simply not being used. And if you talk to the school administrators who do have these programs, who do feed breakfast to kids, they say, problems, we deal with them, we get over them, and it's absolutely worth it. These kids need to be fed so that they can learn. So one of the things we learned from the angry feedback is how powerfully some Mainers feel that help for those at society's margins means taking something out of their own hides. On the policy level, if there's to be support for carrying out measures to help the hungry, then this anger is something that's going to have to be addressed. How to do so is not an easy matter, but it's going to take a level of articulate and compelling leadership that we haven't yet seen here in the state and that we need. So, I don't have all the answers, but there are some big questions that we need to spend time on.
Jerry.
Thank you, David, and thank you all for coming out here. As David said in the introduction, I work with the Maine Council of Churches. Maine Council of Churches is an organization that represents 9 Christian denominations in Maine, as well as the Unitarian Universalist Association. It includes the Roman Catholic Diocese of Portland, the Episcopal Diocese of Maine, the United Church of Christ, the United Methodist Church, the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America, the Society of Friends, the Quakers, the Presbyterian Church USA, and the Swedenborgian Church. And our mission statement says that we are rooted in the Hebrew and Christian scriptures, and our mission is to inspire congregations and persons of faith to unite in good works that build a culture of justice, compassion, and peace. And because our mission is rooted in Hebrew and Christian scriptures, I was thinking about what scripture would ground and root my comments with you here tonight, and one leapt immediately to mind. I'm only going to read you 3 verses, so please bear with me. In the Gospel according to Luke, Jesus tells this parable. There was a rich man who was dressed in purple and fine linen, who feasted sumptuously every day. And at his gate lay a poor man named Lazarus, covered with sores, who longed to satisfy his hunger with what fell from the rich man's table. Even the dogs would come and lick his sores. Now the parable goes on to describe the very different fates that the rich man and Lazarus meet after they both die, but the basic reality of the story is apparent in just those 3 verses. That gated communities separating the rich and the poor are at least 2,000 years old. They were there in the time of Jesus' economy, and just as they are here in ours. So as I was thinking about the topic of the two Maines and the reality of poverty in Maine, we throw around how many Maines there are, and I know in the legislature the number just increases as to how many Maines there are. But there is no wrong side of the tracks in Maine. There's not even a wrong side of the Penobscot River or the Androscoggin River. Poverty exists in every county, in every municipality in our state, and yet we'd like to always push it just about as far away from us as we can. As Naomi alluded to, my colleague, Reverend Dr. Rick Small, is in the audience today. I was just speaking with him yesterday. He is the executive director of the Good Shepherd Food Bank. They supply 1.5 million meals, the food equivalent of 1.5 million meals a month, to other food supply nutrition programs all across the state. And they're in the midst of the general regular leap into the winter season, but that leap is bigger this year, just like it was bigger last year. And the biggest leaps are the food donations that are going to Cumberland and York counties. The divide of poverty runs through racial ethnic communities as well. One of the programs that the Maine Council of Churches works with is a street ministry in southern Maine called Tengo Voz, which means I have voice. It works with the poorest of the folks in the Hispanic community in southern Maine. The economic divide runs through that community as well. The people that Tengo Voz works with are the poorest of those folks who are not able to get much support from the more affluent, though middle class, shopkeepers and business owners who are also part of that Hispanic immigrant community. Our economic justice staff person in the Maine Council of Churches, who lives in perhaps what would be considered one of the more affluent suburbs of Portland, says on a regular basis that that town was richer when there were teachers living next to doctors and bankers living next to carpenters, which she simply doesn't see anymore. Even within the municipality, those neighborhoods have stratified, and even, of course, as we hear all the time, with property taxes pushing people even out of certain municipalities. To that end, we simply don't know who our neighbors are. We would like to push the reality of poverty so far away that we're not even willing to know who those folks are, whether they live at the end of a dirt road in an abandoned farm, seemingly abandoned farmhouse, or whether they live right down the street. To that end, the Maine Council of Churches has worked for the last several years on a program called Hear Our Stories, Know Our Names, which was a drama that was written and produced and performed by either citizens who are currently homeless or have recently been homeless, telling the stories of how they got to be there and what that life is like. And they've toured all over the state, not only to congregations, but also to community groups and community forums, telling that story of and asking people in those communities simply to acknowledge who they are and that they're not stereotypes, but they're actually people who have real issues that need to be addressed by our society. So the question for the faith community, and particularly for the churches that I work with, is where is Jesus in the midst of that? And Jesus is always, always, always in the midst of the poor and the oppressed and the marginalized. And we know that even in this story of Lazarus and the rich man. Because unlike in most of our culture today, it is the rich man who doesn't have a name. It's Lazarus that Jesus names. It's Lazarus who has the needs that Jesus is concerned about and is calling his followers to be concerned about. And Jesus is concerned for the poor and the helpless because he was rooted deeply in the very basic principles of Judaism, with the acknowledgement that we all come from that place of need, whether it's in our own lives or generations back in our own family. We remember where we came from. The reality also for many people in Maine is that there is the fear that that may be where they're going. The middle class, as we all know, are squeezed by the same pressures that the poor are squeezed by, rising energy costs, both to heat our homes in this most dangerous time of year, as well as the rising energy costs to get ourselves back and forth to whatever employment we might have. And yet we have this phenomenon, much as Naomi was describing in responses to her series, that the shrinking middle class in America and in our state tend to blame downward, with the idea that the poorest among us are taking more than their fair share. Think about that for a moment. That poverty and the threat of poverty for the middle class is because the poor are taking more than their fair share. Instead of the reality that wealth continues to be stratified in this state and in our nation, and that the middle class continue to participate in economic policies that are against their own interests. Now, churches know this. Churches know that poverty is where they are called to be. And that's why time and time again, folks in the faith community will turn out for food drive after food drive after food drive. That they will go to deliver that food. They will go to serve that food in soup kitchens. They will collect clothes. They will collect money for heating assistance. But charity is not the solution to poverty. The solution to poverty is economic policy changes. And what those policy changes are, quite frankly, we in the faith community look to the policymakers and the policy analysts, some of which are sitting at this table with me. Our role in the faith community, and particularly in the Maine Council of Churches, is to work with those folks in the faith community who are so concerned about poverty to understand that what we all need to do collectively as individual congregations, as the faith community at large, and as our society together here in Maine, is to work together to lift us all out of poverty, to remove that fear even among the middle class, and that we need to generate the will, both the faith will and the political will, to change our economic policies to be able to lift everyone out of poverty and to put that fear to rest. And part of that begins with knowing who the poor are and knowing our neighbors, because for as long as the poor are the nameless ones, instead of Lazarus or Chuck or Carrie, two of the participants in our drama, or many of the people that Naomi listed, they will always be too far away for us to help. I was speaking just the other day with a member of one of our congregations who happens to live here in Lewiston. I would say perhaps on the lower end of middle class, two incomes, three children, and part of that income is generated by renting out other spaces in a very large house that they happen to own, and which helps pay their mortgage. And as part of that is eligible for some assistance in renovating the home so long as she agrees to rent that out to low-income people, that unit. But this woman who is on the lower end of the middle class herself is afraid of what that means, is afraid of what it means to rent out a part of her building to low-income people, because we rely on the stereotypes of who the poor are instead of knowing who the people are that are just outside our gates. Getting to know who we are as a community, which includes all of us in the community, is about what it means to be Maine. Knowing our neighbors is one of the ideals that we as Mainers ought to be living up to. And until we do that, Maine is a long way from the way life should be. So I look forward to the comments of some of the other policymakers about how we get to the place to advance that policy agenda.
Thank you. Again, my name is Hannah Pingree. I'm a state legislator representing offshore islands and off the coast of Maine. I'm in my fifth or now moving into my sixth year in the legislature, and I again want to thank Bates and David for having us here tonight. I especially want to recognize Peggy Rotundo, who was recognized, but as the Senator for Lewiston, as the one of the most powerful women in Maine, the chairwoman of the Appropriations Committee, the issues that we're talking about tonight on this panel are her problem. But
we're going to ask Peggy to solve it all at the end of the night.
That's great. And I also want to recognize Mike Carey, who's sitting in the back, who's a newly elected representative from Lewiston, who represents one of the poorest census tracts in the state of Maine, and as a new representative really has his work cut out. So I'm glad he's here tonight. I just want to go back and sort of start with what Naomi started with, discuss, which was Maine. We've talked somewhat about the issue of poverty. I'm sure not enough, but in this last week's cover of the New York Times, there was a major article about poverty in this country, and it started that article really framing it around poverty in Washington County and poverty in Maine among our elderly. And it's, I don't know if it's something, certainly not something that we should feel proud about, but I think it's significant that we are now being used as a national example of how poverty is going to affect people. We're moving into the cold season, and I think we've all heard a lot about rising gas prices, about fuel trucks being stolen in Biddeford. I have a sinking sense, and I know a lot of you do as people who live in the state and people with neighbors who are struggling with these issues. I mean, it's going to be a very rough winter. So I think having this discussion on kind of the eve of this winter and also on the eve of us going back into a legislative session where we've seen a significant decrease in state revenue, tax revenue coming in, which means we're faced with a close to $100 million deficit. So we're dealing with issues of poverty, of people not being able to get through the winter and buy oil, of, you know, senior citizens who are struggling, and at the same time we're in a budget scenario that is, I guess, to simply put it, it's pretty ugly. So I think this is a helpful discussion. It's good for me as a lawmaker and me as a legislative leader to sit down and think about these issues, because unfortunately we as legislators probably don't spend enough time doing it. But taking a step back from that, I think some of the comments have been made here tonight about how, do we really know our neighbors? And one of the best traditions, I think, about Maine state politics is because we have publicly financed elections, because we're a relatively small state where members of the House represent less than 10,000 people, members of the Senate represent less than 40,000 people, we get elected by going out and knocking on doors. So every election season, I try to knock on at least 1,000. If the first time I ran, I knocked on over 3,000 doors in the 10 communities I represent. And it's a very good way to see how the people of Maine are living. You obviously, you talk to your constituents, they, you know, they complain to you about issues they're upset about, and, you know, they bend your ear about federal policies that you probably can't do all that much about. But you literally get to see the insides of people's homes. And in rural communities, a lot of those people, when you're knocking on doors, they invite you in and they give you a cup of coffee and they want to really talk to you about their lives. And my district, I represent what I think a lot of people would view is a fairly wealthy part of the state on the coast. And I can tell you, as I think Eric just said in his presentation, poverty is everywhere in the state of Maine. I have lots of constituents who live in trailers, missing windows, you know, taped up. They've got cars filling the front yard filled with garbage, parents raising kids in houses that really have no floor in them, who you're honestly not sure how they heat their house through the winter. And they're the kinds of people who I think that Naomi talked about. They are in every one of our communities, and we as representatives knock on their doors, we ask for their votes, we hear their stories, and I think it's an important part of Maine politics that I think a lot of representatives understand. And then we as representatives have two roles. One is to specifically serve our constituents' issues. So we get the phone calls from the working single mom who is really upset that she hasn't got her child support payment from, you know, the deadbeat dad or somebody else who's supposed to be supporting her family. And we try to sort out those issues working through the Department of Health and Human Services. We talk to our constituents who are upset about property taxes. I have a great elderly couple who's two of my favorite constituents in the town of Stonington, who, when they bought their house more than 50 years ago, it cost them $3,000. Now it's right on the water in a beautiful spot in a beautiful community. 50 years later, their property taxes are well over $4,000 every year. And for two people living on Social Security, they can't pay it. So helping them deal with those issues is something that I think all of us do on a regular basis. So we as representatives have the specific, you know, phone calls that we take, and we try to help people sort out individual issues. But clearly that's not our primary role. Our primary role is to look at the larger policy issues. How do I help people on a more large scale basis on the coast and in communities throughout the state be able to stay in their homes, be able to afford their property taxes? How do we make sure child support enforcement, child care subsidies, how do we make sure that those things are happening on a more global basis? I think when we talk about the issues of poverty specifically, rarely does the word poverty get used in the Maine state legislature. I mean, we talk about every issue in its own silo. John Brodigam, who is the chairman of the insurance committee for the House, was recently at the Maine Summit on Poverty, which I think was a first. I think Eric and some others were there. And he said, I think, that he was really struck by, not very often do I sit down and just think about poverty. I think about health care for poor people. I think about low-income heating assistance. I think about TANF benefits and whether they're enough. I think about the minimum wage. I think about trade policy. I think about the economy and jobs. But, you know, we don't really often say, okay, how do we think about poverty in a more global way? A number of people tonight have talked about Maine's rankings on poverty issues, and I think that people have given some good summaries. I just want to reiterate some of those because, you know, honestly, as a Maine legislator, we talk about our per capita wage. We talk all the time about our tax burden. But to think about where we relate in terms of the rest of the country on poverty, I think, is important. In 2006, Maine's overall poverty rate was 12.9%. So 12.9% of our people were living below the level of the federal poverty limit. For a family of four, that's below $20,000. For an individual, it's just below $10,000 a year. Poverty among our seniors is at about 10%, which ranks us 17th nationally. And the most striking figures, and I think this goes to what Naomi was talking about, poverty among Maine children has increased from 10.4% in 2001 to 16.7% in 2007. We rank 22nd nationally. We have seen the steepest increase in New England of children moving into poverty. Maine also has the highest percentage of people living in deep poverty, below 50% of the poverty level, and this has also increased in recent years. These are statistics that are striking to me, and statistics, obviously, that we should be disturbed by. I think the only glint of good news in a lot of our poverty statistics is that Maine is among the lowest five states in the country for the rate of people without insurance. Maine's rate of uninsured is 9.5% compared to the national average of 15%. So I think some of the issues we talk about in terms of health care, in terms of Maine care, in terms of state coverage for the poor, I think we've actually done a good job in that realm. So I think there are several frames as a legislator that I think about when I was sitting down to think about the issue of poverty. I think the most significant is obviously the state of our economy. People are most often in a state of poverty because they can't find a good paying job, because they're working at a minimum wage job that keeps them in a state of poverty. A single mom with two kids working a full 40 hours a week is still $3,000 below the federal poverty limit. So you can be working full-time and still be poor. And I think that that's something that I think a lot of people don't understand. They assume poor people, people who are on a lot of these programs, don't have jobs. A family of two, both of them working full-time, 40 hours a week at minimum wage jobs, are only a couple $1,000s over the federal poverty limit. And I think that puts that in a strong perspective. Just for everybody's reference point, Maine's minimum wage is now $7. The federal government, after not increasing the minimum wage for almost 10 years, just this past year enacted a minimum wage increase. They this year went from $5.15 an hour to $5.85 an hour. I think most people know that you can't find babysitters or house cleaners or anybody else who will work for that small amount of money. And the fact that that's how we try to, in a policy framework, deal with issues of poverty by setting a minimum wage, it's shameful, certainly depressing, and I think one of the most important things that we need to focus on. In general, also, just getting our economy moving in general. It's a lot of what we talk about in the legislature. It's a topic of a lot of conversation in Maine. It's how you get the economy moving, whether it's through massive tax cuts, which I think, you know, obviously relates to a lot of issues that we're talking about, whether it's infusion of education, how you bring companies to Maine or help companies in Maine thrive. I think it's important when you think about these poverty statistics to remember that Maine has been one of the most affected states due to both federal trade issues and manufacturing job loss. We've seen over the last 10 years, I know this city of Lewiston, specifically over the last 20 years, we've seen a significant number of the traditional jobs in manufacturing that often paid a good wage leave our state, and most of them have left our country. And this is, I think, one of the things driving poverty and one of the things that's really impacted our economy. So rethinking about our economy of the future is clearly one of the most essential pieces of talking about poverty. I think it's not only about jobs, though. It's certainly about our regulations, about our health care, how people access health care. It's about the general balance in our economy. Andy Stern, who's the president of the Service Employees International Union, is on a great national kick talking about healthcare issues, how they need to be solved in order to really deal with issues of poverty in our economy. And he had a couple great statistics that I think are important to think about in sort of a national framework. 7 of 10 middle-class Americans say they are living paycheck to paycheck, have negative savings, and are one illness away from economic disaster. A recent study reported that 87% of all bankruptcy cases are the product of job loss, medical problems, or divorce and separation. Half of personal bankruptcy cases were connected to medical bills. The last most striking thing is wages are at the lowest percentage of national income since the Great Depression, and corporate profits are at the highest level of national income ever. So we have seen tremendous change that I think a lot of people talk about just in the state of Maine, but we're dealing with, I think, a huge change in our global economy, certainly a change in our national economy, and something that we struggle with on a state-by-state basis, but something that I think requires a significant amount of attention at the federal level. A lot of these issues have to deal with regulation, they have to do with global trade, they have to do with our national economy, and the issue of healthcare is, I believe, driving the U.S. economy literally down the tubes. It drives individual families who are faced with a medical disaster without health insurance down the tubes individually. We see our largest car manufacturers going under, being crushed by issues of health care. And I think if you talk to any small business owner in the state of Maine, they say that health insurance is one of the most significant economic challenges that they have. Specifically in the state, you know, aside from these really big issues, we deal on a very regular basis with programs and policies that I think have some bearing on the issue of poverty. Certainly, it's been talked about tonight, education. We are a state that has a relatively low level of college attainment. We have a high level of people with high school diplomas and a relatively low level of people with a higher education. We see employers on a very regular basis come to Maine and say, you don't have the kind of trained workforce we need. We were considering relocating to this area, but you don't have enough workers who are trained in boat building. You don't have enough workers who are, have college diplomas. These are issues that we need to face head on. If there are companies that want to come here, it's not just that they don't want to come here. It's that we literally, in many areas, don't have a workforce ready for the jobs that they offer and the jobs of the future. We've talked about economy and jobs. Clearly, that's an issue we spend a lot of time talking about in the legislature. How do we spur economic development? The state just passed a significant research and development bond, which to some people, you know, it seemed like a lot of big talk about research jobs, and is that really going to create anything in Maine? But we do hope things like investing in R&D will lead to new companies, whether it's new companies in wood composite, new companies in green technology, nice to see Dick here as well. And then there are very specific things that we're going to talk about in this legislative session. Naomi talked about providing breakfast, and I have a feeling that her column sparked a certain state senator, Mitchell, also the majority leader of the Senate, to specifically put in that bill that would require the legislature to ask schools to provide breakfast to low-income kids. So this legislative session, we will be talking specifically about this issue. If you are moved by it, I strongly encourage you to come to the State House, come to a public hearing on that. We're going to be talking about an issue like this in a difficult financial context, but as Naomi states, it hopefully won't cost state taxpayers any money. We're talking this session about the earned income tax credit. Taxes in Maine are a huge issue, if you hadn't noticed or heard about it. Rebalancing our tax code, we rely too much on the income tax in the state of Maine. It hits middle-income and low-income people far too quickly. And how we shift some of that tax burden to people who come here in the summer, to tourists, to people who buy second homes here, I think is a really important discussion. Investing some of our tax policy money into our lowest income people, like the earned income tax credit, which actually we don't have this in Maine, but refunds people at the lowest end. So if you're working and you're paying taxes and you're making a very low wage salary, you get some money back at the end of the year. So it pays to file your income taxes. Clearly issues like the temporary assistance to needy families, Medicaid issues, children's health care, which has been a huge issue federally, the low-income heating program, property tax support. Probably those are the biggest issues we'll talk about this session, and they're the biggest issues we spend talking about on a regular basis in the state legislature. They are the dominant forces besides education when we talk about our budget. And as I often say, you know, budgets are not just a bunch of numbers. How we invest the state's tax dollars, your tax dollars, it really is about our values, and those choices are important. And we're moving again into a legislative session where we don't have enough tax dollars at this point to fund the programs that we decided to fund last year. So $100 million is actually a significant amount. And you will hear and you will read in the newspaper, I'm sure, proposals to cut back health care for the poor, to cut back some property tax relief fund, to talk about reducing school funding. None of these are easy or pretty issues to talk about. But in the context of poverty, I think it's important that we stay vigilant, because there are people who could easily lose their health care. The poorest people, your grandmother in a nursing home, parents living below the federal poverty level, who face in a difficult budget year like this, could lose their health care, could lose their benefits. So I think it's an important discussion that we have in the state of Maine. Another big initiative that came out of the Poverty Summit, Senate President Beth Edmonds is going to put in a bill to start a Maine Council on Poverty and Economic Security. And it's really about the issues we've talked about tonight. We don't talk specifically about poverty. We talk about all these different policy areas. And the intent is to have a group of citizens and legislators who meet on a regular basis and make suggestions about how do we literally reduce poverty. Not how do we talk about all these other programs. How do we make sure that we don't have 16% of our state's kids living in poverty, not being able to afford breakfast or lunch or dinner every day. These issues are a big deal. This is all, again, I think, as Naomi stated well from the letters from her people angry about some of her news stories, it's all going to be framed around taxes and spending. And I think the tax and spending question in Maine is a very important discussion to have. We have real issues with middle and low-income Mainers, in my opinion, paying too much of their income in taxes. We have property tax issues that are literally driving people out of their homes. It's important to talk about taxes, but it's also important to remember that all the tax money we spend in the state of Maine goes to programs that primarily support people, and a lot of those programs are for people who live in poverty, who live close to poverty. Two-thirds of the state budget goes to funding elementary schools and high schools, and it goes to funding our Medicaid program, which are elderly citizens, disabled citizens, and kids who are poor. That's their health care. So every time we talk about Maine's spending, or as some people call it, Maine's spending problem, or we talk about our tax picture, we have to understand that when we make these decisions, we are making decisions about people often who are living in poverty. So I think it's this discussion tonight is a really good way to frame it. The very last thing I'll say is I live in a very small community. I live in a town of 350 people. It's an island off the coast. And the one thing that does give me hope for issues like this in our state, and I think it's not probably that dissimilar in Lewiston, it's not that dissimilar in northern Maine, is we do live in a state where people care about each other. It's a lot of small towns, and when a family's house burns down or, you know, somebody has a major medical issue, people in a community often step up. And I think all of us have been to a potluck dinner for somebody, or a Grange spaghetti supper, or something like that. And I don't think that that's the solution to issues of poverty in Maine, and I'm not trying to frame it that way, but I think that we are a state where we live in small communities, we care about the people around us, we've seen poverty up close. I think we all know people in our own community who are struggling to get by. It's clear by looking at their house they're struggling to get by meeting their children. And I think it's important when we talk about these issues that we don't talk again about people that we don't know. We all live in small towns, and we care about our neighbors. So framing all of these larger economic issues and tax issues around that, I think, is really important. So thank you again for having me here tonight.
Thank you. First of all, let's thank all of the panelists.